This is podcast number 19 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm going to be talking about some lessons from China. Before I share some lessons I've learned from a study of China, I thought it may be helpful to remind you of my objective in doing this. First of all, I'm not trying to tell you these are the things I think you should be studying. Rather, it's just done in the spirit of here's some interesting things I've learned, and maybe something will spark an interest in you, and maybe not. Maybe you're hearing this at the end of month one and you've already moved on to month two. Just make a note to yourself that here's something you want to learn more about, and when you come back next year, you'll have some studies to look forward to. Or it's perfectly fine to extend studying month one into month two. Like I keep saying, this rotation schedule is your servant, not your master. It adds enough structure to keep a little order about your learning, but with lots of wiggle room. But the bigger reason I'm doing these lessons learned podcasts is because I've noticed it's really hard for some moms to get off the facts and information track. When I talk about gems and lessons learned, it's a completely foreign idea. They can't imagine what I'm talking about. And the thought of copying down a lot of facts in a notebook is daunting for sure. How do you begin to choose? Face it, most of the modern books are filled with facts, and there's little to warm the heart and set it to pondering. I don't think it will take you long at all to catch on, and you'll start finding gems all over the place when you read these older books. Little lessons and ideas and quotes that will grab hold of your heart and set you to thinking. And that's when learning gets really fun, because you just naturally start talking about ideas and having conversations about things that matter. And the more you feel your heart, the more connections you'll start making, and it will all begin to feed itself. Facts of themselves have no life. A name on a timeline by itself does little for us. But add the stories and imagination, and the ideas start appearing, and ideas are very much living things. So let's get started with Marco Polo. For me, Marco Polo was a game you played in the swimming pool. One person was Marco, and he'd close his eyes and called out, "Marco!" And the other swimmers in the pool would reply, "Polo!" It was kind of a hide-and-seek game. He had to try and catch them just by the sound of their voice. Do you still play it? I think I bumped into Marco Polo a couple of times in a history class, but he was just a name and we moved on. As I've learned about him, I'm sorry it's taken so long to make friends with him. He has an amazing story. But let's take a detour before we dive into his story. While he was still a young boy at home in Venice, his father and uncle were merchants who made the long and treacherous trek to China, or Cathay as it was called, and were greeted by the great Kublai Khan, who was delighted to have Western visitors. He had never seen a European before, and the two brothers were very intelligent and had much to tell him. The great Khan was interested in civilizing his people, and he asked about the emperors and how they administered justice and so forth, and asked like questions about the kings and queens. If you've seen the older black-and-white version of The King and I with Rex Harrison and Irene Dunn, it reminds me of the scenes between Anna and the King of Siam as he tries to learn to be civilized, etc., etc., etc. I love the musical too, but this version's my favorite. Anyway, he next inquired about religion. Here's what the record says. When that prince, whose name was Kublai Khan, lord of the Tartars all over the earth and of all the kingdoms and provinces and territories of that vast quarter of the world, had heard all that the brothers had to tell him about the ways of the Latins, he was greatly pleased, and he took it in his head that he would send them on an embassy to the Pope. So he urgently desired them to undertake this mission, and they replied that they would gladly execute all his commands. After this, the prince caused letters to the Pope to be written in the Tartar tongue, and gave them to the two brothers. Now the contents of the letter were as follows. He begged that the Pope would send as many as 100 persons of our Christian faith, intelligent men, acquainted with the seven arts, well qualified to prove by force of argument to idolaters and other kinds of folk, that the law of Christ was best, and that all other religions were false and naught. And if they would prove this, he and all under him would become Christians. And the two brothers promised they would return. Well, when they got back to Venice, they found the Pope had died. These were very troublesome times in the church, and no Pope was chosen for 2 years. feeling anxious to return to the Khan, they decided to start the trip back right as a new pope was appointed, who ordered two priests to go with them. He said he couldn't spare any more. And here's the thing. The priests went a short way but soon turned back because they were afraid of the perils of the journey. And so it happened that no missionaries reached China at that time. The great Khan was determined to have some religion taught to his people, and so he sent to Tibet for Buddhist priests. It was in this way and at this time that Buddhism was introduced into northern China. If the great Khan had received the 100 Christian missionaries that he asked for, it is likely that China would be today a Christian country. Do you think the two priests in the afterlife did the ultimate facepalm? Upon that seemingly small and insignificant decision, an entire nation was turned another way. Lesson noted, finish the task you set out to do. Now back to Marco. He was only 17 years old when his father and uncle set out to China again, and this time they took him with them. It was a 5,000-mile trek in a straight line, but there was no straight-line road. The actual trip was three times further. They traveled over 15,000 miles to get there. It took over 3 years, and there was danger and peril every step of the way. Pirates and robbers, snowy mountain peaks, and deserts with little water or food. When they finally arrived at the imperial palace, the great Khan treated them with great honor and asked them many questions. And noticing Marco, he asked who he was. His father replied, "Sire, 'tis my son." "Welcome is he too," said the emperor. Continuing now with the text. Now it came to pass that Marco sped wondrously in learning the customs of the Tartars, as well as their language, their manner of riding, and their practice of war. In fact, he came in brief space to know several languages, and he was discreet and prudent in every way, so that the emperor held him in great esteem. In fact, he made him an ambassador and even a governor while he was yet in his 20s. The emperor trusted him implicitly, and because Marco was always giving his mind to get knowledge and to spy out and inquire into everything, he was sent out on many expeditions and came to visit more countries of the world than probably any other man. Isn't that the kind of friend you'd like your teenage boy to have? For 27 years, Marco Polo lived in China. When he and his father and uncle returned to Venice, they found that all their property and possessions had been sold because everyone thought they were dead. Boy, I sure would have liked to see the faces when they came home after all those years and the stories they had to tell. Well, Marco wasn't interested at all in making himself the center of attention. He was ever polite and ever gracious. When he was asked questions, he answered with such kindly courtesy that every man felt himself, in a manner, his debtor. He had no intention to write down any of his adventures. When you think about it, what would the point have been? There was no Simon and Schuster to publish it. There were no speaking tours. In fact, Gutenberg didn't even invent the printing press until after Marco Polo had been dead for 100 years. It wasn't like you could pull out a pen and paper and write it down. Who was reading anyway? So Marco came home, married, had 3 children. But when Venice went to war, he was made commander of a ship that was captured, and Marco Polo with 7,000 others were taken prisoner and put in chains. What were the chances? Marco Polo ended up in a prison with a gentleman of Pisa named Puticiano. His cellmate was a man of letters. He could write. And during his extended imprisonment, with nothing else to do, he encouraged Marco Polo to tell his story while he wrote it down. And history was changed because, what a coincidence, Marco was imprisoned in Genoa, the very city where 150 years later Columbus was born. It was Marco Polo's writing that fueled the flame of desire in Columbus to travel to these wondrous lands Marco Polo described in such vivid detail, scenes like the king's great palace. This is what he wrote. "You must know that it is the greatest palace that ever was. The roof is very lofty, and the walls of the palace are covered with gold and silver. They are also adorned with representations of dragons, sculptured in gilt, beasts and birds, knights and idols, and sundry other subjects. And on the ceiling, too, you see nothing but gold and silver and painting. On each of the 4 sides there is a great marble staircase. The hall of the palace is so large that it could easily dine 6,000 people, and it is quite a marvel to see how many rooms there are besides. The building is altogether so vast, so rich, and so beautiful that no man on earth could design anything superior to it. No wonder Columbus kept looking. Have you ever thought about how many great things came out of prisons and captivity? Cervantes wrote Don Quixote. John Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Thomas Malory wrote of the legends of King Arthur while in prison. Do we remember that Daniel and Joseph were in captivity where they influenced the rulers of empires and kingdoms? John the Revelator wrote the book of Revelation, and William Tyndale penned many of the words found in the King James Version of the Bible while in exile. Sometimes what we think is a very horrible thing to happen turns into a blessing in disguise. Another lesson noted. Marco Polo's story is full of adventure and excitement, and he proves himself a man of great character and integrity. Which brings up one more lesson before we move on. There are scholars who doubt his story. There are always doubters, aren't there? But whether or not the stories were true, or at least the details were true, look at the effect they had on Christopher Columbus. Thank goodness the stories were allowed to do their work before some scholar somewhere got hold of it and threw it out because he couldn't positively verify the facts. China has always been a mysterious country because they are very guarded and keep to themselves. There was just a small window that allowed Marco Polo to travel about and report back what he saw before the window was closed again. The world is indebted to that glimpse, and happily, that glimpse came to someone who was as observant as Marco Polo was. It has only been in recent years that we are learning as much about China as we are, and what a beautiful and fascinating civilization to discover and learn about. While the Western world was groveling through dark ages, the Chinese were a highly advanced civilization. I've enjoyed learning the wisdom of Confucius. Do you remember that I told you in the podcasting on notebooking how frustrated I've been because I've lost stories along the way? One of the stories was about a city in China that actually did the very thing we're talking about, tending to the hearts of children. Remember, it was Confucius who taught, to put the world right in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must first put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must first cultivate our personal life. We must first set our hearts right. Well, this one town I read about, and the story that I can't find the details of again, actually put it into practice, and it became such a highly desirous city for people to live, rulers of nearby towns became jealous because all their subjects wanted to move there. The people of the city were of such high moral character that they were strong, and it seemed impossible to bring them down. But they were finally conquered, and the thing that did it wasn't a force of arms. One of these jealous rulers sent over young girls to seduce the men. It so weakened them that they were finally able to conquer them. Here's another lesson from China. I keep noting times throughout history where rulers gained power over the people by destroying their books and history. This happened under Qin Shi Huang, 200 years before Christ. In an effort to unify their thoughts and political opinions and to keep scholars from comparing his reign with those who reigned in the past, he ordered their histories to be burned, and those found with forbidden books were killed, and their families. In an old book, I read how the priests, at peril of their own lives, took the forbidden books and hid them in logs and caves and buried them deep in the ground so that when the madness was over, their history had been preserved. As I watch our history being erased and books taken out of libraries and replaced with computers where access to thought can be easily controlled, maybe you will be like the priests of China and be a guardian of our heritage by the books you hold on into your homes. That may sound like a crazy conspiracy theorist, but history has shown me that freedom always has power grabbers lurking in the shadows, and one of the age-old strategies is distancing a people from their heritage. Did you see the story going around the internet recently? A proposal was made to drop millions of iPhones over North Korea. The strategy was that if the people could be exposed to the ideas that have been kept away from them, they would never allow themselves to be oppressed by a regime like that of Kim Jong-un. The idea is under serious consideration. During the Cultural Revolution of China under Chairman Mao, there was another book purge. If you haven't read Yang Cheng's personal account of living in those times in her book Wild Swans, it's very eye-opening. I can't recommend it enough. And by the way, the book is banned in China. I copied a passage of her book in my notebook. I think it's difficult to comprehend the kind of mind control they were under. As it turned out, Yang was assigned to learn English, and some librarians had saved some old books in their library attic because they were written in English and so they didn't prove a threat. As she read classics like Little Women, Jane Austen, the Brontes, and other European and American literature, she wrote, "My joy at the sensation of my mind opening up and expanding was beyond description." She continued, "Being alone in the library was heaven for me. My heart would leap as I approached it, usually at dusk, anticipating the pleasure of solitude with my books, the outside world ceasing to exist. As I hurried up the flight of stairs, the smell of old books long stored in airless rooms would give me tremors of excitement. I became acquainted with Longfellow, Walt Whitman, and American history. I memorized the whole of the Declaration of Independence, and my heart swelled at the words, 'We hold these truths self-evident, that all men are created equal, and those about men's unalienable rights, among them liberty and the pursuit of happiness.' These concepts were unheard of in China and opened up a marvelous new world for me. My notebooks, which I kept with me at all times, were full of passages like these, passionately and tearfully copied out." Sharing even that account with your children may help them appreciate something that they may take for granted. While this isn't a book for young children, if you have mature high schoolers, I think it's a powerful book for teaching an appreciation for freedom by showing them clearly what it looks like to not be free. As much as we condemn the loss of millions of lives under Chairman Mao, God has a way of turning the messes we make over for good, and we are seeing a new China emerge after clinging tenaciously to so many traditions they've held for thousands of years. The Cultural Revolution did provide a break with the past, and their story certainly is not over. Well, there are many more things I could talk about. I've gone on long enough for one day. China and their people fascinate me. We need to get to know them. One thing that made me smile was there was a part in Wild Swans where Yang said that as children, they were told by their parents to think about all the poor little capitalist children in America who were starving and to eat all the food on their plates. I think we both have a lot of misconceptions about each other. If you haven't read Gladys Aylward's story yet, if you want to be inspired with the power of love, it's a must read. And I noted that the way she opened hearts that were seeped in superstitions and traditions was through a story. Long ago, in a faraway land, lived a carpenter who was gentle and kind. A simple story softened and opened the hearts of hardened generals and hardened criminals. It's a powerful book about courage and determination, but mostly love. For today's poem, how about the classic poem written by Coleridge, the English poet? He had fallen asleep while reading Marco Polo's story and dreamed the poem beginning, "In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. And here were forests, ancient as the hills, enfolding spots of sunny greenery." I hope I can go there someday. But for now, bye-bye. See you next time.